Episode 30 of Outlander Cast is brought to you by the tag You're It Etsy Shop. From Outlander-inspired necklaces and rings to custom designs for birthdays or any occasion, every piece is created by Dawn, one letter at a time, and is one of a kind. Please take the time to visit Dawn at www.tagyourit.biz. That's B-I-Z. Tell her Marion Blake sent you, and use the coupon code OUTLANDERCAST15 for 15% off your purchase. As always, tag your mama, tag your pet, tag your it, whatever it is.
People disappear all the time. Most are found eventually. Disappearances, after all, have explanations. Usually.
Outlander Cast with Mary and Blake. It's a podcast dedicated to the show Outlander on Stars. Hello, hello, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I'm all pumped to jack again for Outlander after that San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh my goodness, so much exciting stuff. Love seeing the pictures especially, because you can just tell everyone there had an awesome time. I mean, I was a little jealous. I do have a newborn in my hands, so it's okay that I didn't go, but I kind of was jealous.
I was going to say, I really, really want to go to the next one. I think we should make it a point. And anybody who wants to come with us, I say, let's bring it all on.
We'll have a wonderful little train.
Let's do hashtag SDCC16.
There you go.
I like that.
Honestly, we would be there if we didn't have a 6-week-old in my hands
now. And a 2-year-old.
Gosh, man.
Who's going to watch our kid?
Yeah, I don't even know.
Nobody wants to watch our kid.
Diana Gabaldon would not be able to because she's there. She's there. She can't watch our kid. Who knows? Someone will. Well, nonetheless, yeah, tons of great things seem to be going on with just the energy of Outlander. You know, we, of course, finished this first season. Now they get to go into Comic-Con. There are people with kilts, with bagpipes, tons of interviews, tons of fun things. You've been able to see pictures and get kind of little snippets and sneak peeks about what to expect in season 2.
And the best thing about all of this is that they're already filming season 2. Right now, as we speak, as you listen to this right now, it's being filmed. And granted, it is going to be a very long time before
a serious Droughtlander. We thought Droughtlander was tough.
Oh wait, I thought we were going with Withoutlander.
Withoutlander? I mean, times a million. That's really what it is. It's going to be a long time, but you know what? That means you get to reread the books if you are a book reader like myself. Or for Blake, you can just rewatch the seasons. Mm-hmm. You can continue to listen to the amazing work that Bear McCreary has done. I can't wait for his next CD to drop of the second half of this season. And you can listen to interviews like the one that we have today. You rewatch the series, you know, while you're sad and you're missing your Jamie and your Claire. You can watch an episode and then say, wait a second. Oh, I get that. That was mentioned in that interview on Outlander Cast by, you know, when Blake, that guy with that funny Boston accent, when he was interviewing Ira.
You always got to throw a dig at me, don't you?
I love you.
Don't you? It's yes. Okay.
So to help make Droughtlander or Withoutlander or just this long time that we've got to go before we get some good old Jamie and Claire loving.
Otherwise known as hell.
We are going to have some awesome interviews for you. And I'm pretty excited because today's is Ira Stephen Bear.
That's right. And if you don't know who he is the writer of many episodes, including The Garrison Commander, To Ransom a Man's Soul, and also Wentworth Prison.
He wrote some tough stuff, guys.
He wrote like a lot of the legwork for this season.
But instead of us telling you about Ira, let's have Ira talk about Ira. Let's have Ira talk about what he wrote and what he did and did not do.
Let's just get to it.
He did everything, let's be honest.
Thank you.
Joining us today is Ira Stephen Baer, a television producer and screenwriter, most known for his work on Star Trek: The Next Generation, but especially on Deep Space Nine, on which he served as showrunner and executive producer. He was also the executive producer and showrunner on Crash and Sci-Fi's Alphas. But we all know him as a writer and executive producer on our favorite television show, Outlander. Ira, thank you so much for joining us here on Outlander Cast today.
Absolutely.
Why don't you start off by telling us how you came into Outlander?
Well, that's simple enough. Ron and I had been actually talking for maybe close to a year about doing something together, and we were working on a number of projects that we were trying to get off the ground. And so we had been meeting more than we had in quite a while, and that was a lot of fun. And, you know, we were just trying to throw balls up in the air and see what would land. And at the same time, I knew he had something going on at Stars that we really hadn't discussed it. And so when he called me and said, you know, something just happened and, you're one of the first people I'm calling, I want to know if you'd be interested in doing this with me. And all you have to do is read a 700-page book and give me your answer in a week. So it was like, okay. So I was unaware of the whole phenomenon of Outlander, but I sat and I read the book, and I called him back, and I told him it seemed interesting. I had no idea at the time whether or not I could write this material, something from the 1700s in Scotland, something that all the writers turned out to share, that same kind of, can we actually do this? And I said yes, and next thing I knew, we hit the ground running. And that seems like about 5 years ago, and it's at least over 2 years ago, and so far we have 16 episodes of television to show for it.
In addition to being a writer, you're actually an executive producer on the show. Right. To an average fan, what is that, and what is that like? What is your day like on a set of Outlander?
Well, that's kind of two questions. The executive producer credit can mean a lot of different things. Mainly, it's often given as a kind of bone to writers in lieu of money, or because they have climbed the ladder. So it can be a kind of meaningless title. I've been a showrunner, obviously, for a number of years. So, it depends. When Ron's not in the room, I kind of run the writer's room. On the set, I do what everyone does, which is basically I'm here for a block of episodes, since we shoot, unlike in the States, where you shoot one episode at a time. Here, they shoot two episodes at a time. In this case, for the start of season two, we're shooting three episodes at a time. And the job, besides all the pre-production work and casting and meeting with the directors and meeting with all the department heads and all the sidebar meetings and meetings, and rewrites, production rewrites. The job, once we go into production, is to be on the set throughout the shoot, be there as kind of, I guess you can say, quality control, but the directors would probably have my balls for breakfast if they heard me say that. It's basically just to know the intent of the scenes and know where we are at any given time, since when you're doing multiple episodes at once, it's easy to get lost and what the scene was before and what the next scene is after, and just to be on the set and be there to answer questions and to make sure that the ship stays on course.
Given your history with Ron, it sounds like you're kind of his consigliere. Like he goes to you with the issues that he has troubles with. Is that true?
I would say that I've used that term myself many times.
Oh, smart men think alike. I'll say that.
Yeah. So yes, there's a lot, and you know, we have an amazing shorthand. I think at times maybe too much so for some of the other writers. I know that you know, there are times I have his ear in a way that the other writers sometimes feel like they do not. So it's a fine line you have to walk, but you know, I'm there to be as honest as I can, you know, and not be shy about stating my opinions, but at the same time, I get it. I'm there to be a supportive, you know, piece of the puzzle, and that's what I do. So, you know, that's how last season, when I was originally going to write as my first script episode 3, and episode 6 was broken by the staff, and I could tell that, and Ron could tell that there were some issues about the confidence in that script, and I just went to Ron and I said, look, if you want me to do it, I'll switch episodes and I'll do 6. And he said, yes, thank you. You know, you know, I know you'll do it, and you'll, you know, we'll get a great script out of it. So it's that kind of stuff, you know?
Well, so episode 6 being the Garrison Commander, you have credit on that. You have credit on Wentworth Prison. Obviously you have credit on the finale to Ransom of Man's Soul. It seems like you've pretty much cornered the market on Black Jack Randall. Was this by design?
It certainly wasn't by design. Like I said, I didn't come in to the show. I mean, the main thing, I think, that I came in with was the whole Angus Rupert, that relationship, and bringing them as characters in a more upfront way than certainly they were in the books. And that was my thing coming in. And we even went back in episode 1, not episode 1, in episode 2, you know, and added, you know, the Rupert scene. And I was a big proponent of those two characters. Not everyone agreed with that at the beginning.
Which scene are you referring to?
The scene where Rupert is following her and he says, I'm the eyes and ears of, yeah, that's a scene that I wrote a couple of scenes. Some of them, obviously, since we were trying to shoehorn them in what were basically completed scripts, were difficult, and some of them never. There was a funny scene with Angus and Murtaugh at one of the dinners at Leoc that I wrote and got into the script, but we had to pull it out because we didn't have time. So the Rupert thing survived. But, you know, that was my thing. I wasn't thinking about Blackjack at all until I got into the Garrison Commander. And then knowing that there wasn't much there from the book, there was a very small section of the book and not very detailed except for the punch, it gave me a chance, as Ron said at the beginning, to write basically a one-act play. And that's when I really got into the character and, you know, started to come up with all these little pieces that interested me. You know, there was a lot more with the general and the other soldiers in my script that had to be cut for time. But, you know, it was the small details, the pouring the wine out of the window, the line, the truth bears a weight that no lie can counterfeit. I mean, there were things that I just discovered along the way that made it, these little things that started to fascinate me, and I realized just what a complicated, I never really thought about Blackjack much or that he was a complicated character, except that he had a wicked dark side to him, but that wasn't all that interesting at first for me. But then as I went through it, and yes, then I became Blackjack, and on other episodes I would be brought in to punch up the Blackjack scenes, and then obviously writing 15, and then Ron got stuck and asked me to jump onto 16 and write all those scenes with Blackjack. So suddenly I'm the Blackjack guy, and I read about how wonderful Tobias is, and I go, interesting.
So getting back to the episodes 15 and 16, I read somewhere, I forget where, but Diana Gabaldon provided you and Ron some notes on how to handle Wentworth, apparently. With that said, what kind of research did you do, and how did you get into that mental place to write such a controversial television episode? In other words, what was it like trying to break that story with Ron? Like, I know you said you just brought him, he brought you on to 15. What was that whole process like? In 16, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, which I don't know if it makes for good, stories or not, but actually I wrote Wentworth Prison in something like 6 days. I just kind of zipped through it. And when I talked to Ron and I said, hey, you want to read 15? And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, well, I'm done. And he goes, you're done? That was fast. I said, yeah, I mean, it was, I wasn't doing anything else at the time. It was quiet in the office, so I just, there were things that obviously the book helped with, but again, there were things from the show itself. Now that we had a history with Blackjack, that whole six about talking about, how he had made this masterpiece with Jamie and that connection, his obsession with Jamie. It just, at that point in the season, I had spent so much time thinking about Blackjack that, as I said in other interviews, it was a lot easier to write than actually watch them film. That was very uncomfortable watching it, but the writing of it was just, the characters are rich and interesting. It's an interesting situation. It's a disturbing situation. The part of rubbing his face and licking the how does it feel? I always get excited when I feel like there's one line, not necessarily for the audience or the actors, but for me, that kind of sums up the episode for me, what I'm trying to achieve. So when I wrote the line in 15 about what does it feel like to be alive yet wear so much dead flesh, I mean, that line just explained a lot to me. And, that obsession, yes, there's the sexual aspect of it, but the sexual aspect was not as interesting to me because I knew that was going to happen and it was there and people were going to talk about it and blah, blah, blah. But it was getting to there. That's why adding the situation about Blackjack coming to give him an honorable death, that seemed like an important thing to keep Blackjack from being just a a cliched, crazed horror type of villain. I mean, he did have this code of honor that he cared so much about Jamie that the mere thought of him hanging was such a death that was unworthy of him. And he really wanted to give him a worthy death, you know. And if not for the cattle stampede, you know, Ron and I talked it over, and it was like, yeah, without a doubt, he would have killed him. He would have honored his part of the bargain and killed him, because there was no way he could save him at that point. Not that he necessarily even wanted to save him, but so it was, you know, I look back on it, and it's like any script. You get into a zone. You have zero pages when you go in there. All you have is a blank screen or a blank pad of paper or whatever. And 6 days, 8 days, 10 days, 12 days later, there's 50, 60 pages. And every time I do it, and I've done it a lot, I look back and go, how the fuck did that happen? Where was I when that was going on? Well, you know, it's all a blur.
Magic of the process. Well, some people have said that the show went too far with how graphic those scenes were in the last two episodes. So what would your response be to that claim?
My response is everyone is allowed to have their opinion. The one thing that does that I find that always leaves me with a kind of quizzical feeling is that, you know, I collect books. I read a lot, all different types of books, lots of fiction. I see a lot of movies. I am a compulsive movie watcher. I watch movies from all times, from the 20s to the 2000s. I watch American films, French films, German films, Italian films, you know, films from all over. And I never judge a movie by, you know, whether I find the contents disturbing or whether I agree with things that people do. It seems like a very simplified way to go about viewing something or reading something. You know, yes, it's entertainment, and it takes you out of yourself, and it's all that stuff we could talk about for hours about the experience of creation and viewing, and, you know, no time for that here. But the idea that there's images that are disturbing, things I don't like, things that make me uncomfortable, that's neither bad nor good. That I never take that into consideration. Is it, you know, is it necessary? Does it work? You know, that's what matters. So when I hear all this discussion about, you know, I didn't like it because I had to watch this, or I didn't, you know, it made me feel this, and oh, poor that. I have a very hard time dealing with that. You know, there's a lot of things that go on in life, a lot of them good and a lot of them bad. And execution, when it comes to portraying them, is everything. And I never once felt any sense of discomfort that we were being gratuitous or that we were taking advantage of the situation. I remember when I read the book, I thought, wow, crazy ending. You know, what the hell is this? I didn't see this coming. But okay, that's there. And that's what this is about. This is that part of the story. So I kind of zone out, which is why I never, well, let's not say never, but I hardly ever read, you know, blogs and sites and all the, our job is to do the best show we can do. And then it's up for everyone else to decide whether we succeeded or failed. And I can't do anything about that. It's out of my hands at that point. And, as one of my one of my favorite lines in movie history is, "All I want is to enter my house justified." And I think with the first season about Len Greifeld, we could all enter our houses justified, and that's what's important.
You know, we read an article in The Observer, which we actually really agreed with. They said that the viewer needed the unblinking eye of the camera to see what was going on here. It compelled the viewer to watch it. And that in the end, it was the excess that created the success for the episode. And with that in mind, you talked about the experience and was it necessary? I can understand that everyone has their own opinion, but what would you say to a viewer why would you say that it's necessary for the story?
Well, I think why it was necessary. Well, that's the story about that relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the story. So we were either going to sugarcoat it and, dumb it down and kind of lean away from it and, you know, make it something that had no reality. And I don't mean like reality. I'm talking about like the reality of the show. It had to fit into the reality of the show. What had come before, how we dealt with things before, and it was all had to be of a piece, and this is what's going on. There's nothing worth, turning away from or lowering the eyes in a situation this ugly. You know, it's like, yes, if the audience doesn't want to look at it, that's fine. They can turn away, they can lower their eyes, they can change the channel. But we have to look. We as the creators, we have to look at it. We have to present it. We, you know, and I know it's, you know, people keep talking about rape when obviously this doesn't quite fit into what people usually think about rape, which is a whole other discussion, which I don't feel like getting into, I kept thinking if Jamie was a woman and this is 2015 and we're doing a show, are we going to be truthful or are we going to lie about it? And I think, you know, with the way television has grown up, I think, to a certain degree since The Sopranos and the new golden age, as they keep saying, of television, you know, you have to go for it. That's the material, and you have to do it. You have to try to make it as honest as possible. And when it just cracks me up, because there's so many things we could have done if we really wanted to be, you know, if our whole, you know, if her whole reason was to horrify or to take advantage of the situation, good grief. You know, we could have made it really ugly, and just kept it going and all that kind of stuff. But we did not. I mean, that's not what the intent was. So, that's the story. Diana took it to a dark place. And, dramatically, I think it works very well. In some ways, I think it works. It's focused more, a little bit more than it is in the books, because in the book, you know, you can digress and you can get into long discussions about this, that, and the other thing, and describe this. There's less of that on a TV show. You have less time, and it's just more immediate, and it lives in front of you. So that's what I would say to that person. I was talking to that person, and that person wanted to talk to me and actually wanted to hear what I had to say, but that conversation is never going to take place, most likely.
Well, we're going to switch gears.
It was all make-believe.
It was a make-believe conversation with who knows who.
It was a good exercise. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's right.
So I wanted to know if there's anything that we saw as viewers in any of these episodes that you had to fight for to make it into the final product.
Wow. Are you talking about 15 and 16?
Yeah, we can stick with 15 and 16. Yeah, we can stick with those two.
Wow, I got to think about it. Yeah, I mean,
if not, don't fret. I just didn't know if there
were. I mean, there were things, but they're, you know, like the, you know, like the scene in with them in the tavern at the beginning of 15 with Angus and Rupert and the finding out the information. You know, there was a question about whether we needed that or whether the humor was a correct way to go. But at the end, Ron said, oh, thank God we had those moments, you know, the ending when they're saying goodbye on the beach and the kind of strange goodbye with Rupert and Angus and Murtaugh. And, you know, to me, the most poignant moment in the whole show, believe it or not, is them sailing away in that rowboat and Willie standing there alone watching them go. You know, Willie to me is another character who didn't really exist and we almost didn't use, and it was only when we hired Finn that we really realized that this was a character who we could use and be a whole other texture in the show. And he obviously is in love with Claire, though he would never articulate that. And he's this young, very religious kid. And I don't know, there was something, him not being able to tear himself away, which I found very emotional, that that could have easily been lost. You know, there was one shot that Ron cut that I really wanted to keep in. But he said he blinked, which was in the second rape scene where Jamie acquiesces to Blackjack's advances. There was one long shot that was pretty disturbing, which we're talking about putting into the extras, maybe on the DVD that just wasn't even written in, was just something that the actors did on their own, but I thought was really good, that I wish we had kept. Really uncomfortable.
Can you talk about it, or you want to leave that?
It's only a shot. It's a shot, and oh, okay. To describe it would be to lessen the impact. So
we'll leave it to that.
Let's hope they put it in. I wish we could actually cut it into the show itself, but I doubt we can do that now, mm-hmm. even for the DVD. But anyway, I have to say, you know, I had a really good experience season one of Outlander. I mean, yes, there were things about some of the scripts, 10, by the pricking of my thumb was, you know, had a lot of, you know, it was covering so much ground. And, you know, I think we needed a little more time to shoot some of the stuff that left me frustrated. But that's such a rare occasion. And even that show had Simon Callow as Sandringham, which I had such a good time writing. And I got to actually write my first kind of like sword fight, you know, you know, which was great because I didn't want it to be a sword fight. I wanted it to be a brawl. And I really was happy the way that turned out. So I just, you know, I had a really good time. And I really, I know it doesn't, you know, because everything's about 15, 16. But creatively, I felt very good, let's put it that way. Not so much having a good time, because writing is always a, you know, I wouldn't quite describe it as a good time. But I really was creatively fulfilled in season one. And it's I only have, you know, good thoughts about it. So
as dire as these past two episodes were, there was a lot of balance, like I said, about between the humor and the terror, and love.
Light, dark.
Yeah, yeah. But ultimately, I felt like these episodes were about love. And do you feel that love conquers all in Outlander?
I think that the Jamie, the Claire Jamie story is obviously at the heart of the show. And their love story is a pretty great, optimistic love story, though there are other love stories. You know, the Frank Claire story is pretty damn interesting. And the Murtaugh Jamie story is pretty interesting. And the Angus Rupert story is interesting. And the love hate between Colm and Dougal is interesting. And the Leary Jamie, I mean, there's tons of relationship stories. But yes, I don't know if love conquers all, you know, because the story has barely begun, and these people go through some heavy changes. But I think it's unlike a lot of shows where in the history of television, where when the couple gets married, it kind of like loses its steam, and you know, what next? Once they're married, the story seems to end. That's not true with Outlander, and I think that their story continues, and there's a lot of healing that needs to get done. Obviously, there's a lot of changes in store in season two, but I think ultimately that relationship is something that the fans want to watch, the writers want to write to, you know? And so yes, in spite of all the darkness in the series and all the pain and suffering, emotional, physical, in the series, I think ultimately it's an extremely positive story, you know, about love, like you said.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your extraordinarily busy day to speak with us on Outlander Cast. We really appreciate it. I can speak for Mary in saying thank you so much. Our listeners are going to freak out when they hear this. And it was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. I've been a huge fan of yours since your days on TNG and even DS9. And it's I'm kind of like fangirling a little bit here just to speak with you.
Well, I hope it wasn't too much of a disappointment. And once again, congratulations on the new baby.
Thank you.
And all good things for you guys. So,
thank you.
And all good things for you. I know that, as we said, you're starting off, you're doing all of the filming over there in Scotland already and with your long night. So we wish you the best and lots of good coffee.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
Wow. Thank you once again, Ira, for joining us. What an awesome guy.
He is amazing. And you know what? I love the fact that he had something to say to all the detractors of episodes 15 and 16. They're saying that it went too far, and it didn't go too far.
Well, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, in my perspective.
I agree, but you know, his answer and his reasoning was, listen, this was part of the story. It was part of it. Whether you like it or not, it was part of the story. And we either could accept it and make take the challenge and move forward with it, or we could back away.
Well, and that's the thing, is that everyone's entitled to their opinion about if they were comfortable or enjoyed seeing that, or if they thought it was appropriate. But you really get to hear why it was in there from the person who got to help make that decision's lips.
The guy who wrote it.
So, you know, whether someone felt it was needed or not, I was telling you that it was his job and he wrote it, and there's why. And I'm so happy that we got to hear why.
Yeah, and he did the best that he could. And obviously, a lot of thought went into it. And a lot of pressure, I think, was built up because of it. The other funny thing I love about this is that he was not brought on to necessarily write the character Black Jack Randall. He was mainly brought in to give the comedic element to Rupert and Angus. And he just somehow grasped the idea of Black Jack Randall in the meantime.
Love it. You know, all three of those guys, such big personalities. Mm-hmm. And obviously we need Black Jack Randall for the protagonist, but the antagonist. Here I am saying for, meaning for Jamie to have an antagonist.
There
I had,
you
like,
go.
I had a full beautiful sentence in my head, and then I remembered I had mom brain. for the protagonist to have his conflict. And of course, Angus and Rupert for the lovely comedic effect. You know what they really reminded me of? They reminded me of C-3PO and R2-D2. Especially in that last scene, you know, when there's the boob grab.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things like that. I was like, oh, this is kind of like when C-3PO and
R2-D2 ever did a boob grab.
Are walking along in the desert. You know, it's kind of like the same shot. I want to do a side-by-side of them watching the... Not, they didn't actually even watch the boat fly sail away. See, I almost said fly. I need to stop having children. This is what happens. Your brain, you know, that your brain on drugs.
The last time I checked, they never did a boob grab in Star Wars.
I hope not. I hope
you
not.
Know, I'm still wrestling with that ending, by the way, with the boob grab. I'm still wrestling with the idea that it went a little too far. Like, it seemed out of place.
Well, I think just because, as I said before, sexual assault had just happened earlier in that episode.
Yeah.
So then for something like that, inappropriate. But for, you know, Ira even said that they needed to have a little comedic, some lightheartedness.
Yeah.
And I sure do just love that shot of that boat sailing away.
I know. And if you haven't got a chance to listen to our final episode for To Ransom a Man's Soul, we actually closed out our podcast episode with the entirety of the finale, like the last scene of To Ransom a Man's Soul. So please go back and listen to that. We have the whole scene with Jamie and Claire and the pregnancy and the beautiful Bear McCreary music. It was really awesome. It was such a great treat. I'm really happy that we came up with that idea.
Oh, you're such a smart man.
Well, wicked smart.
I'm not smart right now. I've got mom brain.
All right, my
love. Well, thank you, everyone. Yeah, this was just great.
What do you say? You want to close out the show?
Yeah.
All right, let's do that.
As a reminder, Outlander Cast is brought to you by the Tag You're It Etsy shop. From Outlander-inspired necklaces and rings to custom designs for birthdays or any occasion, every piece is created by Dawn, one letter at a time, and is one of a kind. And I want to let you guys know that Dawn made me an awesome necklace. It has my son's name, Reese, with a very unique spelling, R-H-Y-S, which I guess isn't unique to those who might be in Europe, but it's not really common around here. So it says Reese, and then another name, which is Felicity. So it's my two kids' names. So it is beautiful. Dawn made it with her hands, and it's custom, and I love it because now I have my kids right near my heart always. So please take the time to visit Dawn at www.tagyourit.biz. That's B-I-Z. Tell her Mary and Blake sent you and use the coupon code OUTLANDERCAST15 for 15% off your purchase. As always, tag your mama, tag your pet, tag your it, whatever it is.
Guys, if you love OUTLANDERCAST and you need more of Mary and Blake, you can always find us at OUTLANDERCAST.com. There you will be able to find the Mary and Blake store, my ebook on how to get your friends and loved ones to watch Outlander with you. And then also you'll find this little Support Us tab, and you can click on the Patreon page and become a patron of OUTLANDERCAST, whether it's $1, $2, $125 billion. We will be glad to accept any contribution that you'd be able to make.
And if you want to stay in touch with us during Dratlander, without Lander, or hell, as Blake likes to call it, you can reach out to us. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and sometimes Tumblr, but I'm not really good at Tumblr. I don't understand GIFs, guys. I'm sorry. I'm trying. Anyway, our handles on all social media platforms are the same. It's OutlanderCast, just one word.
Oh, another thing, too, is that all of our episodes now are on YouTube. Every single one of them, not only just for OutlanderCast, but for all of our Tall Mom Media projects, for like our parent cast and the Living Reminders, and everything that we do is on YouTube now. So please go to YouTube and search Tall Mom Media, and you will find every single episode that we do. And not to mention this, Mary and I are going on a big trip. We are going on a huge trip to the podcast movement in Fort Worth, Texas. So if any of you are in Fort Worth, Texas, please, please send us an email. We'd love to get together and have a drink, meet up, say hi, you know, hang out, kibitz, and go through hell together. What do you think?
Oh my gosh. And you can meet Felicity because she's coming along for the ride. Well, thank you all so incredibly much for tuning in. And thank you once again to Ira. We had a great time interviewing him. As always, my friends, I'm Mary.
My name's Blake.
And you've been listening to Outlander Cast.